artistic expression is usually a reflection of what's happening in society. And it's only politicized when the dominant power culture decides that what is being expressed is outside of their need, right? So it becomes political because of that. And so advocacy is, I think, is embedded within almost every single story. You know, everybody has something that they need or want to be changed in order to create the best possible life for themselves.
Welcome back to Voices of the Community and our latest episode featuring voices from the second annual California Arts and Culture Summit hosted by California for the Arts. I am your host, George Koster. In today's episode, we explore creative equity, providing artists with the resources and support to succeed. Hear from artists, educators, and advocates shaping a sustainable future by investing in the arts, fostering job opportunities, and creating spaces where the creative workforce can thrive and grow.
Hi, Eduardo Robles for Californians for the Arts and Voices of the Community here at the second annual California Arts and Culture Summit. Here with Tiara Amar, just got out of the Creative Conditions panel, and we're happy to have you here to talk a little bit further on your key takeaways and just some ideas that you were able to discuss with the other panelists. You know, just go ahead, take the mic.
Totally. Yeah, I feel really lucky to be here at Whippoorwill Arts. We work with musicians. We're a musician-centered organization, so we really prioritize the perspectives of working musicians. And it was cool to really talk about the things that are on the minds of musicians. So guaranteed pay is their top priority, the opportunities to play for small listening audiences, and then consideration of the musician's cost of doing business when determining compensation for them. And it was cool to put that in a conversation in a room with such experienced people in like different parts of the creative ecosystem. So to hear what that looks like from a policy perspective, from Jamie, to look like what that looks like first from the city's perspective, from Marcus, and then to talk through the AI, the technology question is really interesting too.
Yeah, like at the core of it, it's like a lot of like art worker rights, right? Like some basic human rights, you know, rights to their creative expression, to be able to work and thrive. And so heard a lot of interesting strategies that you're involved in. Can you speak a little bit more about some of those kind of guaranteeing income strategies or kind of pooling money and just kind of elaborate more on what you're doing?
Yeah. So we work specifically on the live music ecosystem and what that looks like. And the live music ecosystem and how people are paid for live music has changed a lot, actually. And what we work on specifically is how can we expand what the live music ecosystem looks like? So expand to non-traditional venues that makes music more accessible to folks who don't have access to it. So that's like public schools, prisons, hospitals, care centers, Section 8 housing, places where, you know, based on like a lot of research, a lot of scientific research on benefits of music, physical, social, where music is really needed, but music is not accessible. And it is interesting because the idea of artist work is real work has not been really accepted in the music economy. It is still not in a lot of places in the music ecosystem accepted that the performance of live music is labor and that all labor necessitates compensation. And so to say even like the music industry is in a place where even to say that like musicians should be paid for performing music, period, is not commonly accepted. So that's part of the transformation work that we're trying to do is get this as a bottom line principle for the ecosystem that the performance of live music is labor. All labor deserves to be compensated. That's step one. And then step two is how can we do it fairly? How can we do it transparently? How can we do it inclusively for Black and brown folks, disabled folks, queer folks?
How do you see musicians as art workers, but also music, it's also cultural heritage and, you know, tradition bearers. How have you encountered those kind of in advocacy work in terms of like advocating for artists or culture bearers?
Yeah. So live music is humanity's oldest ritual, you know, like drumming together is one of the first things we learned how to do. And musicians are such important keepers of history of a place, keepers of community. And in the past decade in the Bay Area, we've seen such a mass exodus of musicians from the cities that they were integral to building the culture of. In Oakland, blues musicians having to leave Oakland when like Oakland has been such a like pillar of the blues, that's really heartbreaking. And we know that musicians are vital cultural workers. They're keepers of the history of our spaces and they're builders of the future. We have a fellowship program that's specifically focused on roots music, where we model what deep investment into roots music can look like. And it's like one of the only, if not the only, grant of its size that's specifically focused on roots music. So we offer $25,000 grants to exceptional roots musicians. And one of our fellows is Jaron Blind Boy Paxton. And his fellowship project that he's going to be working on for the next 18 months is building old American banjos. Old American banjos being an instrument super vital to Black music, to the evolution of Black music, and also the future of Black music, that are no longer like commercially manufactured at scale. And so his project is to do that real work of learning this practice of building the banjos and then playing music with them.
Amazing. Amazing work. Amazing work. Especially as we have, you know, rich tapestry of, you know, culture traditions throughout California. And so just interested in that, you know, as we, you know, legitimize, you know, artists as workers, but also culture birds as workers, you know, that they're being employed in some interesting projects. But how do we, you know, build the actual policy, you know, actual language in legislation? What topic in the panel just spurred your curiosity? You wanted to learn more or you think needs more attention?
Yeah, definitely. What I'm really working on right now in my advocacy work is thinking about how can we engage musicians in the advocacy work itself, and also how can we engage them with the things that they already have skills in doing, with the things that they're already experts in. And so we have been working with a number of other organizations based in the Bay Area on the Fair Play Initiative, which is a grassroots campaign to call upon the officials of four cities to recognize musicians' work as labor and set pay minimums for the work of musicians in their city charters. So nowhere in the country are there procurement standards or prevailing wage ordinances for musicians. But this is true about other types of work. Other types of work are in each city's charter, like there's pay minimums for work. So we're working with the Union Local 6, working with Jazz in the Neighborhood, Independent Musicians Association, Richmond Jazz and Blues, Demonstration Gardens, and a bunch of other allies and folks who have come together to involve musicians in this advocacy work to talk to the cities of Richmond, Oakland, Mountain View, and San Francisco, big one, to advocate for musicians being included in something like a prevailing wage ordinance. And it really stems from the idea of like there should be pay minimums for musicians' work. And also there should be set working conditions under which musicians can do their work. There's very limited professional protections for musicians. They're often working in really unsafe conditions for very long hours that aren't compensated. So this is a legislative campaign we hope that really will protect musicians and help it be more sustainable for them to live in the cities they want to live in the cities that they are like fundamental to the cultural heritage of. And so, yeah, we have exciting news on that front. We're working with legislators in San Francisco, in Richmond, you know, building movement, getting the musicians involved, and as always, centering their perspectives on what they need.
So there's a real opportunity here for California to lead, right, in building creative policies for, you know, musicians.
Yeah, if I can, I mean, there's millions of dollars that we put into the arts, never enough money that we put into the arts, but there are millions of dollars. But very little of it gets to musicians. Even when the municipality is investing into big events with live music, there is no pay standards for how musicians should be paid, what they should be paid, how they should be treated. And that's not anyone's fault. There's just like not an infrastructure for folks in the city to be trained in what a reasonable rate of pay is for a musician. And so this campaign is also like our collection of organizations can offer that training to the cities of like, this is what an ethical engagement with a musician would look like. And just setting a pay standard, setting considerations, offering advice on accessibility and safety. And it's a really exciting opportunity for the cities and also for us.
In terms of like art workers, the movement, you know, just basic rights for arts workers, how do you see yourself aligned, you know, alongside other folks in the summit?
Yeah, I really resonated with what Marcus said, who was in the panel, which is like, why did he get into this work? And part of that was that he wanted to take care of his people. And that's something I really resonate with. I really wanted to take care of the people around me, my community, who I'm very lucky are a lot of artists, are a lot of queer trans artists of color who we know are so fundamental to like the culture of the society that we live in, but are often completely underpaid, unrecognized for their contributions to that. And it is such an exciting opportunity to like be in a place where I feel like I can contribute to the shifting of the tide, you know, get money in the hands of the musicians, of the artists who really deserve it. And also money with no strings attached. So not like apply for like a nine-stage grant, then you don't get the grant, but just like, here's a grant. There's no strings attached. Do with it what you need to do. And we all benefit from that. Another thing that came up is that when you give money to artists, like it's almost the best way to pump money into a community. And what we've realized through our fellowship program is these are huge grants, $25,000 grants. You know, the first thing that a musician will do when we give them a $25,000 grant is give it away to the musicians around them. You know, they'll rent the studio. They'll hire local musicians. They're so collaborative in their practice. And so it's like not really giving one person $25,000. We've essentially been able to like reach a lot of a local art community by making one serious deep investment and trusting a musician who is like within that community, who knows that community, to distribute it. Yeah.
You mentioned a little bit of research that you guys commissioned. Can you talk a little bit more on that research? And I'm just interested in if there's any like economic data, you know, as you know, now they're the Bureau of Economic Analysis is, you know, collecting all sorts of data, mm-hmm. and, you know, live venues and art has there been a conversation with, you know, that data?
Yeah. Yeah. So our research stemmed from witnessing a lot of the mythology associated with artists during COVID and wanting to disrupt those things by getting the perspectives of musicians and collecting data on their livelihoods and incomes. And so our research was able to identify the top three priorities of working musicians and also notice that COVID wasn't such a drastic shift. It definitely exacerbated really long-standing problems in the music ecosystem, but it wasn't the birth of these problems. These are like long-standing problems that we need intervention on. And so we found the top three priorities of working musicians, which is guaranteed pay for a gig, like I was saying. I think I said this already. Mm-hmm. Consideration of expenses, small listening audiences. And with that, we wanted to also explore like what are the solutions? What are the interventions that are working? And so while the first part of our research really fleshed out some of these like economic challenges that musicians are facing, musicians who make the majority of their income from performing or teaching, they're being paid at the same rates that they were being paid in 1985, which is completely untenable to live in a city like San Francisco, live in a city like Oakland. And we also found that like there was a lot of momentum in with the uprisings in 2020 to change how folks are hired. But there's still such a high level of discrimination in the hiring process that we really wanted to address, especially for musicians with disabilities and especially for Black musicians. And so those really shaped the way we approached the like last piece of our study. So there's a 4-piece study. And the final part is the recommendations that I was just talking about, the recommendations for ethical pay and professional protections that we released that highlight case studies around the country for folks doing really experimental and imaginative work to kind of reimagine what artists' work looks like. So it also looks at how businesses can change longstanding practices of not paying artists. So for example, we worked with an organization called Northwest Folklife on a Super Folk Festival in October, November 2022. And Northwest Folklife, and huge credit to the artistic director of Northwest Folklife, Benjamin Hunter, who really called in the changing of a longstanding history of like not paying musicians at Northwest Folklife. And in our collaborative festival with Whippoorwill Arts and Northwest Folklife, we were able to pay the musicians a really solid amount of money for the first time in Northwest Folklife's history. And so the key to our research is also demonstrating that it is really possible to change longstanding business practices, and it benefits the entire ecosystem, venues, businesses, presenters, artist audiences, to pay musicians fairly.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time and talking to us a little bit more. And, you know, thank you so much for sharing all of this knowledge. And we're happy to share some of your research.
Our next guest is Nurit Siegel-Smith, the executive director of the Music Forward Foundation. She believes in the power of collaboration and the importance of shining a light on the often invisible workforce behind the arts.
Hi, Eduardo Robles with Californians for the Arts and Voices of the Community here at the second annual California Arts and Culture Summit here in Sacramento, California. I'm here with Nurit Smith.
Yeah.
And our board member.
Yes, I'm a new board member and I'm really excited to be a part of this team.
Yes, and Nurit just facilitated a panel on creative conditions, very stimulating conversation on, you know, how we're building protections for artists, initiatives for artists so they can thrive. And just wanted to, you know, follow up on that conversation, maybe like some insight that you got from the panelists and just your overall take on the needs for, you know, building creative conditions for artists to thrive.
I love it. So I loved moderating this panel on the conditions for the creative economy, what we're seeing, some trends and the impact of technology and innovation for our community. I think we just scratched the surface, frankly. I know from having an earlier conversation with these panelists that there is a wealth of knowledge and research and learnings that have come about over the past few years. And I do think that COVID really helped move and exacerbate a lot of the challenges, but also the opportunities to solve those issues that we've been seeing inside of the creative economy. I wanted to make sure that we weren't only talking about artists, but the whole holistic view of the creative economy. The work that I do at the Music Forward Foundation, majority of it is about career paths within music and live outside of being on stage. You know, what are all those jobs and careers in the space? And I feel as if one thing that popped up a few times is even how we define the creative economy. Some think that it's just artists that make up the creative economy, but there are hundreds of thousands of jobs that are not just the person on stage or painting or doing the artwork, but everybody else supporting and empowering that artwork. So I want to make sure that that conversation is being brought to light in all that we're doing. The O-Net codes was brought up at one point in the conversation, and this is specifically talking about occupation codes that define all the different jobs that the Department of Labor is identifying and tracking. And the majority of jobs within live entertainment are not being tracked. And as Nicole mentioned as well, there are animators and new industries that are based out of like graphic design and animation that are artists that are not being defined and their occupations aren't being tracked. And what happens is that if it's not being tracked at the Department of Labor, education is not teaching into it. And we're seeing more and more a divide between education and industry. And I could tell from some of the conversation that was happening on that stage too, on our panel, is the education of artists is not being taught again in that holistic way of how to monetize your art, how to write grants for your art, how to build your network, right? How to build these cooperative and collectives to support your work. And part of that has to do with our educators not having those tools and the knowledge. And the Department of Labor on the other side, not identifying these careers and occupations. So that's why we keep seeing this misalignment between what is being taught in schools and the workforce.
So we're seeing,
I didn't get to talk about it.
Yeah, no. I mean, we're seeing, you know, that artwork is real work, and we're seeing, you know, art workers utilized across the sector, but yet there is that undefinable workforce, the creative workforce, right? Like how do we speak, like you said, as a unified sector to the Department of Labor, for instance? Where are you seeing the clarity? Where is, like, how is it, you know, crystallizing. We have Prop 28. We have, you know, the Housing Act, you know, and all of these kind of legislations. We just had that big summit with the NEA, you know, health and well-being.
Yes.
So there, it seems like it's happening, but just not like throughout the sector, you know, like, I guess what I'm just trying to say, it's like, how is it more like articulated as a unified workforce?
Right. Well, I think one of the challenges is so much of the work we do inside of this economy is invisible. We literally wear black to be invisible backstages, right? And so I think one of the first things is identifying all the jobs, all the roles, all the people that make up this workforce and articulating it from the Department of Labor all the way right into the community and inside of schools. So they're learning career technical education that is aligned with the jobs that are available. You know, this is why I love California for the Arts and California Arts Advocates. This is why I'm a part of this coalition in the state of California, is because we cannot do it alone. We have to find those partners, the collaborators, the artists that are able to share this story, share their lives, share their careers. And that's how we'll be able to continue to shine a light on this multi-billion dollar force here in the state of California. Did I answer
your question? Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. So it's like a labor movement, kind of. We need to organize.
Completely like a labor movement. And there are organizations like Music Forward that are helping to rewrite some of those codes and identifying some of those industry codes as well, not only the occupation codes that reflect what we are doing today, not what we did 50 years ago, right? Because the technology has impacted the roles, the skill sets needed, the platforms that need to be understood, how artists monetize has changed dramatically. So we have to be able to teach that and then advocate to make sure that the resources and that the effort and time and experience that artists and this economy is putting into our society, into our world, is being given the resources that it needs.
How do you see education right now kind of stepping up to support, I guess, this workforce, much needed workforce? There is, you know, our education has proven that, you know, it helps, you know, students thrive in education. So how are, you know, superintendents, how are they moving art and culture to be more, you know, invested in education?
Well, it's interesting because I come at it from a little slightly different angle. We work in not music education. We work in music business education. I advocate for more of this learning of the business side of the arts. So as young people are being taught instruments and dance and stage and painting and all the different modalities of art and creativity, we want to make sure as they're heading into sophomore, junior, senior year in high school, that they're also being taught skills in entrepreneurship, right? They're also being taught that careers in music don't end in band and orchestra, right? And we have partners inside of the California Department of Education that are seeing this and are tapping industry partners to help refine and redefine what career technical education looks like. And I think that that goes back to the partnerships to be able to ensure that our young people in this state and the next generation are as ready and prepared and have been exposed to so many careers and opportunities that they can see themselves mapped into the creative economy.
Yeah, so a lot of infrastructural work, I think. You know, even if they're, you know, folks doing arts administration, it's still like the pipeline is still not, you know, it's not like becoming a teacher or like, you know, the practice of becoming an art worker. There's a lot of barriers. So how to, you know, make it a little bit more smoother, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, higher education, you know, like how is higher education, you know, supporting this workforce too? Because you have folks that are coming out of the humanities, coming out of the arts, and, you know, there's no formal kind of entrepreneurship, you know, formation to, you know, come out into the world and support like us, that system, a system of the creative ecosystem.
Right.
So what do you see in higher education? Who is leading in higher education in terms of like this preparation for artists and arts workers?
Well, I think what's great in that CTE space as well, that goes up to what they call grade 14. And so community colleges are also leaning into this space. And I love pipelines that we're developing, like with Compton Unified School District into Compton College into an apprenticeship. And I think that that's where we're able to really see higher ed step in, because we've now positioned an apprenticeship as a goal. But we also know that higher education is not available to everyone, right? Whether it is a barrier of money and resources, or that it just is not part, doesn't work, and that's not how they learn and grow. We want to make sure that there are opportunities on the job training, that they're learning and earning at the same time, because so many careers inside of our economy doesn't need a four-year college degree. But if we can find and define those pathways and pipelines, then we can help this next generation thrive.
Well, thank you so much for all of this rich conversation. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Eddie.
Creative equity means supporting artists as vital workers. Our guests have been discussing the importance of fair wages, advocacy, and investment to sustain cultural innovation. This program is brought to you by these generous sponsors and listeners like you, whose commitment helps make meaningful conversations like this possible. Thank you. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. Voices of the Community is also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Before rejoining our insightful interviews with the California Arts and Culture Summit panelists, let's hear from other summit attendees. Our roaming reporter, Eduardo Robles, is gathering perspectives from summit guests.
So we're here at the California Arts and Culture Summit, and I have with me
Danielle Brazel, Executive Director of the CAC.
Gloriella Garcia, the Operations Manager for CAC.
Yep, we're here at the summit for Artwork is Real Work. What has been the highlight of the day for you?
Well, I will tell you, the highlight of the day has been the incredible panels and really being able to hang out and be with my colleagues and learn from my colleagues from across the state.
Networking, getting to know another aspect that I'm usually not used to seeing, and learning from all of you.
And, you know, it looks like we're a movement, right? Like, there's just so many conversations that, you know, art and culture is, you know, advancing. You know, what is the future looking like?
So seeing the movement at this stage, some of us have been at it a really long time. And what I'm seeing is that the momentum continues to increase And the advancements are actually happening. First of all, the strategic plan that was unveiled today for Californians for the Arts was absolutely amazing. And to see how far we've come and yet how far we are to go.
What, yourself?
I'm burying you at this.
No, but we're all, that's how we're all convening and learning from each other. So the points of the summit, right? Like we're changing the narrative.
Yes.
We want more people, you know, we're building the movement. So
yes.
Where do you see yourself in this movement? Or where are you in the movement?
Where in the movement? I got to say, I'm more, because I'm operations, more budget focused, very strategic in that realm. So I am, what's the word? I'm embracing the art, our creativity, and I want to expand that a little bit more in knowledge. And so, yeah.
So I want to just say, shout out to all of the people who manage the contracts, who move the money, who manage the bureaucracy, who make sure that arts, culture, and creativity is getting into the hands of communities throughout the state. And this woman right here is behind it all.
Yeah. That's the artwork is real work. That's the art worker, you know. That's the movement. You're moving the work forward.
Art workers are accountants. Art workers are operation managers. Art workers are facility managers. They are supervisors. You know, there's no question that in order to be an arts worker, it manifests in multiple ways.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Danielle, for taking the time, you know, to, you know, talk to us and, you know, for welcoming us to Sacramento. You know, you're the leader of the Arts Council, and congratulations on that appointment.
And thank you,
very
Eduardo.
Inspired for your leadership.
Well, Eduardo, likewise. We've known each other a minute, and it's really great to see you blossom, and I hope you are thriving.
Thank you so much. Hi, we're here at the California Arts and Culture Summit, and here I am with Alex.
Alex Gallardo with the Arts Council of Kern.
Alex, what brings wonder? How is artwork real work or cultural work or economic work?
I'll go with the first question you asked was, how do you nourish wonder? I think it's an opportunity. Give the opportunity to the people who want to grow and are wondering. So just giving out that opportunity and being a part of it and helping them out, I think that's a good way to nourish it.
Yeah, what did you like today?
Experience. I was here last year. I liked it last year. This year was also really good. A lot of good topics to talk about. I manage the Arts and Corrections Program with the Arts Council of Kern, so I always kind of take a little bit there and how to make my program better. And I think there was pretty good points out there today.
Yeah, you're part of a bigger movement of how, you know, like art and culture is being, you know, kind of used as a solution.
Yeah, you know, we really want to empower those that are feel like they're powerless, feel like they're forgotten. We really want to bring that out there and also give them that sense of that, you know, they can do. They can still contribute to the community. They can still do things that, you know, make them feel as a community. So,
yeah,
I love it. It was good. Beautiful.
Wonderful. So we got a little story on wonder. Can you tell us a little bit about your community, how you're taking all of this back to your community?
Well, like I said, we are Arts and Corrections, and we plan to grow and expand. So part of my thing is to recruit artists, teaching artists to go and to give back to the community, give back to the institutions. So, yeah, man, it's just a positive thing overall.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Hi, this is Eduardo Robles with Californians for the Arts, and I'm here with our board member,
Delug Smith.
Yeah, so we're here at the summit. What has been a through line in all of the conversations, or what has been most inspirational for you? What is the emerging thing that we need to be, the urgent priority we need to be doing to advance, you know, rights for cultural workers, investment into art and culture?
Yeah, I would say that one of the most outstanding recurring themes that I've been hearing through the day is the imperative of continuing to center artists and their livelihood and their creative contributions, that everybody else in the ecosystem needs to be making that the starting point. And that from there, then we're going to see stronger community, we're going to see more dynamic futures, we're going to see the integration of arts in the overall well-being of California. So I'm excited by the number of artists that are here and the way that they're really owning that imperative.
Yeah, we're here at the California Arts and Culture Summit, and I'm with
Ines Nefsi. I'm with San Diego Art Matters. We were formerly SDRAC, but now we are San Diego Art Matters, and we are an arts advocacy group.
Wonderful. So what has been like the highlight of the day for you? What which one was the panel that most inspired you? Or I bet they were all inspirational. Which one is your favorite?
My favorite was the first one, which was Art is Health. And so I saw that as, that is the work that me and my community are doing. And so to see that from the outside and get recognition for that as like healers of our community was very impactful. I did tear up. And then all the information on Prop 28. And I plan on bringing that all to my community. It's a little bit fuzzy for us. And so to get that information here was super helpful.
What do you think the importance is for like these convenings, these summits in terms of advancing advocacy work?
To understand that we are so powerful. We are all here, we're all doing the work, and we're not alone. And there's a lot of us. We're doing great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eduardo.
Let's return to our one-on-one interviews with California Arts and Culture Summit panelists as they share their insights into the critical needs of our creative workforce for fair wages, policy advocacy, and community investment.
Hi, my name is Eduardo Robles with Californians for the Arts and Voices of the Community, here with our keynote speaker, Nataki Garrett. And we are going to talk to Nataki about some of her key points in her keynote address. One being, was very thrilled with your ideas on the role of the artist in society and, you know, the policies that are emerging for artists. And it was great that you highlighted some of these initiatives that you're a part of. And where do you see, you know, more policies emerging? You identify arts and health, you identify arts and the environment, but in this kind of, in your ideas of transformation, how do you see the role of art and the artists?
Well, first of all, thank you. Thank you for the question. I kind of believe that what is happening in this country is it's catching up with ideas that are already in motion. So when Arts for Everybody was born through One Nation, One Project, one of the things that has happened over the past few months is the revelation that in some of our collaborations, people have been doing this work for decades. You know, they saw the need, they focused on ways of solving the problems within their communities, and they were looking for other ways to support it or for resources to help them continue to do what they were doing. I feel like President Biden is also catching up. You know, I feel like this idea that you might make policy around something that everybody accesses. You know, when I lived in Oregon, one of the things that kept coming up was we can't fund the arts because we have to fund houselessness. And I was like, well, even the unhoused need access to the arts. And so I think that there's a tremendous amount of possibility with this sort of future focus on creating more policies. Policy for me is like money. So we need the resources to be able to continue to support artists in the work that they do. And then you have to kind of listen to the artists because the artists will tell you, right? So the policies that I spoke about were created by artists. And so how do you deepen that and further that? You make sure that the artists have what they need so that they can keep their ear to the ground and listen to the needs of our country and culture.
Yes. And, you know, I really admired, you know, how you are kind of identifying, you know, the need for transformative work in these kind of ecologies that have already been harmed. You know, and you're mentioning kind of the houseless and youth. And so in terms of social justice, you know, and how we are, you know, moving the needle on that. How about your positioning the artist as this transformative maker? How about, you know, organizations or entities, funders, how can they support, you know, this kind of move, this transformative work?
Yeah. So like I just sort of focused on my speech on after having run a few organizations and really trying to figure out ways to shift the organizational focus from, I don't know, donors and, you know, the whether or not the patrons feel like there's enough room between their knees and the seats in front of them. How do we refocus the energy of those spaces on being a space for artists to thrive? And so I do believe the mandate of organizational culture, especially arts organization, has to be around how do you serve the people who are actually bringing this, you know, this richness to everybody's lives? And I think the other thing is about access. You know, I worked for a theater once and, you know, we had this conversation with community leaders, and this one very important community leader was late to the meeting, and she said, I just couldn't find the door. And I was like, well, this is a public theater. You know, at the very least, you should know how to access the door. That's our fault. You know, how do you provide access? How do you make sure that everybody knows that they're welcome? How do you open up the possibilities for welcoming people? How do you give them access to the work that happens on the inside? How do you invite people into spaces so that they know that it's for them, right? I experienced this at my last two organizations. You know, patrons who didn't really want to shift the way that we brought audience in because they didn't want to sit next to people who weren't their friends, you know? And I think that's where some of our arts organizations are stuck. You know, how come there's not a lot of resources in the arts industry? Because we've relied on ticket sales. And that's okay, you know, rely on ticket sales. But, you know, you have to expand who comes, and you have to expand who buys the tickets, and you have to expand the invitation to make sure that everybody feels like they are a part of what you're doing. So I think that policies that focus on helping to stretch and broaden our horizons around how we build audience is going to be really important as well.
And how do we move beyond this one-time pilot funding? Like, what is the game changer in the arts? Like, there was the arts and, you know, well-being, you know, conference that you mentioned. You were amongst all of, you know, the leaders in the nation. Where are we going in terms?
Yeah, so I was at the NEA had an arts and culture summit, and that was led by the NEA's director, Maria Rosario Jackson. And, you know, this really strange moment where the folks from the Department of Transportation were like, we got billions of dollars and we want to help the artists have access. And, you know, but then when they read the paragraph on the policy where you're supposed to access it's like not even written in a language that anybody can understand, much less write a grant or proposal to get the resource from there. Right. So I do think that the future is about greater accessibility. You know, I think that those people who make policy decisions and allocate resources for people to have what they need in order to make the art that they do, they actually have to make it more accessible, you know. And then I remember having a conversation with a major grant funder. And one of something that stuck with me in that conversation was this idea that, you know, it's really hard to replace a grant from my organization is what the person basically said. And I was like, well, what if you created a granting process that didn't require replacement? You know, what if it was about, what if inside of the source funding was a way to help the organization build out a way to gain more resource over time? I worked for an organization that had funding for a project that was focused on local tribes, Native American tribes. And of course, as soon as the funding ran out, the project was over. And so you're just abandoning people, right? And so, you know, somebody approached me about creating a different project, a new one. And my thing was like, I'm not going to create anything unless it meets two criteria. The first is we'll start this project and we will not end it until the people that we are connecting to and collaborating with feel like they've gotten what they needed out of it, right? And so the second thing is that we actually have to invest in ongoing funding, not the one-off funding. You actually have to build it into the program so that you're sourced out for 5 years. And then in the second year, you're sourced out for 5 more years beyond that. And then if the people say after 8 years, they don't want it, you reallocate that funding towards something else and you start a project, another project that can begin and end with the needs of the people that it's servicing, as opposed to, you know, all these great servicing organizations and foundational funders, they get to say, oh, we're serving all of these groups of people, right, for 10 minutes. And then they move on, right? And I just, you know, as somebody who grew up in Oakland in the 80s and 70s and 80s, and I'm somebody who benefited from some of those programs, but really literally they'd descend into the area and then they'd create a program. And then, like, you know, next year it wouldn't be there anymore and you'd be out, right? And so I think we have to stop those kinds of policies, those imperialistic policies that are really not helpful and they don't build in a connection to people. We have to be a little bit more like LA Symphony, what they're doing. You know, they infiltrated the entire school district in LA. And they were the ones who decided that everybody should have access to music, right? And they just raised money to make sure that could happen.
Now, just kind of going back to the artist, there is the transformative moment of the artist becoming an artist. But how about the artist becoming an advocate? It seems like we need more of that for this kind of like sustainable, you know, advocacy investment. What was your kind of like turning point into like more policy driven, you know, practice?
Birth. My father wrote the charter for the first ethnic studies program in the nation at San Francisco State. He was a part of the group of people that started the San Francisco State strike, which is the longest student strike in U.S. history. My mother was a student there at the time. They ended up moving to D.C. They built a school with their hands called the Center for Black Education. It's in my blood and bones. I guess I'm an anomaly, but I also feel like, you know, artistic expression is usually a reflection of what's happening in society. And it's only politicized when the dominant power culture decides that what is being expressed is outside of their need, right? So it becomes political because of that. And so advocacy is, I think, is embedded within almost every single story. You know, everybody has something that they need or want to be changed in order to create the best possible life for themselves. And, you know, that's what usually what plays are about, you know, people really investing in and looking for and living through circumstances and looking for a way to survive those circumstances and to live in a world that's better than the one that they're in right now, you know. And so that's a part of it.
So I guess that's how we're going to get arts for everybody.
Yes.
You know, we need to do that. Thank you so much for, you know, taking a moment to talk to, you know, Californians for the Arts and Voices of the Community.
Of course.
Really appreciated and very inspired by all of your work.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you, Eduardo. Yes. Thank you.
Our next guest is Tamara Misty Sandifer, the CEO of Studio T Arts and Entertainment and a passionate advocate for arts and a champion for economic justice in the arts. Join us as we explore the challenges and opportunities facing artists today and how we can all contribute to a thriving creative ecosystem.
Hi, this is Eduardo Robles with Californians for the Arts and Voices of the Community here at the second annual California Arts and Culture Summit. We just got out of the panel, Achieving Economic Justice Through Community Placekeeping. And I have our moderator for the panel, our esteemed board member, Ms. T. Sandifer, who brought very inspirational facilitation on the topic. And I just wanted, you know, to hear a little bit more on what inspired you today with these panelists, or what inspired you with the audience? There was a lot of, you know, kind of engagement with that, and just invite you to, you know, kind of talk about.
Sure. Well, I think some of the key things that presented themselves, I mean, we didn't script anything that we did, and we knew going in that we wanted this to be a two-way conversation rather than information dissemination. So some of the takeaways I would suggest is the fact that artists are living in the future and that we're problem solvers and solution bringers. And I think that was really brought home really well. As it pertains to economic justice, yes, we can visit the money piece. And we even had somebody in the audience who become a mentor for people in starting and building their nonprofits. But in addition to that, the wealth of words and the wealth of knowledge and the wealth of language that only exists in certain realms, and learning that language so you can exist in these additional realms that cause you to be more successful in your craft and in your career. And I think those sorts of things typically only happen when you're in community with like-minded, like-hearted people that are willing to kind of do that exchange, that unspoken exchange. And I would also offer, you know, we talked a great deal about place keeping. Some people will suggest, you know, there's a buzzword, place making, but we wanted to delve into place keeping. Not only is it about you making space to make your art or become an artist, but how about place keeping so that there's some level of permanence to your existence as an artist, but also where you can create and disseminate your creativity from. And so even touching, you know, brushing the surface of difficult to talk about things like gentrification and redlining as it pertains to occupying real estate that you call your own. So, you know, just the panel was, it was rich. It was fun. It was funny. It was exciting. And I believe that people walked away lifted with actionable steps, how they can grow, not just as artists, but as artists who are making money and changing other people's lives.
Yeah, this really, you know, call to leadership, talk to your community, mm-hmm. you know, build those leaders, that intergenerational, you know, lifting up. And so, you know, what are, you know, there are business models, you know, there are individuals, like seeing kind of community, how do we build community? Because there's gatekeepers, there's folks right. with, you know, with good intentions. And, you know, they get shut off. How, you know, as, you know, we think of building leaders, how do we build support system for folks that might not have a lot of support within the community?
Well, I think, you know, one of the key ways that came up, especially during the panel, is talking to people, like talking to people, even people that you don't know, that's not necessarily in your realm of day-to-day activity, but show up and talk. That was number one. The other thing was just dissemination of wealth. Just, you know, in a more strategic and intentional way, instead of giving to the people that are lateral or the people that you know or the people that you see regular, how about generating downward or generating left or generating right or even generating up in a way that, yes, okay, there's an organization that they do this in this specific community. We don't typically fund this sorts of work, but we're going to fund this work this time to see if we can get these outcomes so that we can get this new data that we can kind of play around with that shows us how to build arts different and build art stronger. And I think that that wealth transfer, I think was a word that they used, was a very important addition to the conversation, because most often people ask the question, but they ask the question among their peers. How can we solve this problem? Well, maybe the solution to the problem doesn't exist in your immediate circle. It may exist to the circle adjacent to your circle, and being a little more broad in how we're asking for help and how we're developing a solution. And then, you know, it was really made very clear that, you know, artists, again, we live in the future. And I like that statement. That was the golden statement of the hour, is because we really do. We create forward. And so having the resources we need to continue to build forward, we can move arts from being, okay, let's respond to this situation because now everybody's hurting, they need healing, et cetera, et cetera. You can move it from a defensive tactic or defensive, you know, response to proactive response, because now you have the resources you need to build forward or to build ahead. And so as the world continues to unfold the way it unfolds or situations present themselves, we're ready to tackle them because we've already built forward. And so I think, you know, continuing to have conversations and then activation communally in that way, I think that you could start to reshape challenges that most communities are facing just because we're forward thinking and then forward acting and then forward funding.
Mm-hmm. So we're seeing this emergence of placekeeping, right? Like mm-hmm. we spoke about this glossary of definitions mm-hmm. of, you know, how do we, you know, engage, you know, decision makers or even like community organizers? How do we empower folks to have the tools to, you know, to politic, you know, sure. and be able to negotiate, leverage resources? So can you speak a little bit more on how you see the emergence of placekeeping? There was, you know, Arte Americas, there was some examples, sure. there was, you know, the
Destination Crenshaw.
Which culture. Have, yeah, yeah, they have like an economic
Studio T,
right? Like there's a business model, right? Sure. There's like an economic model, for profit model that as we start to, you know, define, you know, placekeeping mm-hmm. so that it's not, you know, an abstract concept to, I guess, a decision maker.
Well, yeah. I think it is a narrative that has attached itself to practicing artists, to teaching artists, and to, you know, artists. This is their full-time thing, that the narrative is that you get take up space where you can, you get paid what you can, or you do your art for exposure. Well, that's a narrative that's attached to who we are and what we've built in the past. Well, I think, you know, especially, you know, some of the things that are coming through the, not just the conversation, but the different organizations represented on the panel, is that we can shift that to an owner mentality, shift that to, you know, yeah, okay, that's what you guys do, but I don't have to starve to do this. Even, you know, yes, you're a 501c3, but that doesn't mean you only have to survive and sustain. If you get a grant, you can make money with your art. And so shifting the idea and the narrative that you can't make money, or you have to survive, or you should have to stay in survival mode as a creative, like none of that really applies when you're in a multi-billion dollar industry called the arts. People make millions and millions and millions of dollars being creative. So just allowing people, or helping people to allow themselves to shift the narrative that's attached to them as an artist. You can shift an entire economy just by allowing yourself to be monetized, or your creative disciplines to be monetized, and then share. Once you get a solution, once you break through a barrier, once you learn something that has monetized you at another level, share that information, share that education, and make those connections. So now you're breaking through, but you're helping others break through.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Ms. T, for taking the time, you know, to talk with us. Again, this is Californians for the Arts with Voices for the Community.
Thank you for being part of this exploration into creative equity here on Voices of the Community. A special thank you to Tiara, Tamara, and Nataki for their inspiring perspectives on creative equity and sustainability in the arts. Their work highlights the importance of fair compensation, inclusive policies, and the vital role of community investment. We also extend our gratitude to our summit guest, Danielle, Alex, Delug, and Inez, for sharing their firsthand experiences in the creative economy. Before we go, we want to invite you to take the next step and get involved in the incredible work shared by our guest today. Head over to voicesofthecommunity.com and click on Where Art Meets Impact, and check out episode 7 to learn more about each organization featured in today's episode. While you're there, explore the other 6 episodes from season 2 of Where Art Meets Impact, and catch up on season 1's 10 episodes we co-produced with Arts for a Better Bay Area. Support your local arts community by volunteering, donating, and speaking up at your local government agencies. Stay connected and informed by subscribing to our newsletter at voicesofthecommunity.com. Together, we can ensure that the arts continue to heal, inspire, and uplift our communities. Thank you for watching and listening to Voices of the Community in our latest episode of Where Art Meets Impact. Until next time, stay inspired, stay engaged, and stay creative. Today's episode was made possible through our co-production partnership with California for the Arts at their 2nd annual California Arts and Culture Summit. Special thanks to our technical crew, audio and video wizard Eric Estrada, and our production partner Bayvac Media and their team, Paula Argoni, Andy Konami, Javon Giles, and Clay Go. Thanks to Casey Nance from Citron Studios for the graphics magic. A special thanks to our broadcast partners who help share these important conversations: KSFP LPFM in San Francisco, KPCA LPFM in Petaluma, Petaluma Community Public Access TV, and Bayvac Media's SF Commons Public Access TV. Thank you for your commitment to amplifying diverse voices and perspectives. Please support these partners and our mission by tuning in and spreading the word. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. And we love your support to continue to make shows just like this one. Go to georgecoster.com and click on the donate button. Take Voices of the Community with you on the go. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Enjoying the show? Please rate and review us. It helps more people discover these important stories. Watch past and future episodes on YouTube by searching for Geo Coster. Have feedback or ideas? We'd love to hear from you. Email George at georgecoster.com. I'm George Koster from San Francisco. On behalf of our team, thank you for joining us. Until next time, remember, your voice matters.